I watched an episode of Lost, still catching up. At about midnight last night, and then at about 1 o'clock, I realized I can't fall asleep. I'm just gonna have to ask myself some questions. So I went into the hotel bathroom and I was like, you know, how many days did it take you to do that treadmill dance?
You started asking yourself.
Yeah.
I have some bad news for you.
What's that?
You don't remember. I'm gonna get. We would get the deep dark secrets over with, because if I don't, I'm not doing.
Yeah, that's fine.
I'm not doing
due diligence. Let's do it.
So as of this morning, when I clicked four more times because I wanted to make sure you had the right numbers.
Yeah.
13,263,083. So when I started, it was only 80 for this too shall pass. Now you're not just a band; you are a viral phenomenon that will be studied for years to come. Do you think that maybe that will get you into the Smithsonian if nothing else will?
Well, I asked myself the same question last night, as a matter of fact. And
What did you say?
Well, actually, it wasn't just the Smithsonian. Will that get you into the Air and Space Museum, Damien? And my answer was probably not into the Air and Space Museum, but maybe some other of the hallowed halls of the Smithsonian Institute. We definitely, you know, we've been very lucky to be at the right place and at the right time, I suppose. Whether or not this moment in internet history will wind up being like, you know, the old golden era of internet video at some point, or if this is just a, you know, another passing fad, who knows? You know, for us, what digital space offers is many more dimensions of creative possibilities that you certainly couldn't find just working within the major label system and putting out CDs. So it's less important to us whether or not these things are lastingly meaningful. And it's just, you know, what we want to do is spend our life making things that are exciting to us. And our records are exciting to us, our songs are exciting to us, our concerts are exciting to us, the videos are exciting to us. You know, we kind of chase our creative leads wherever they follow, and when the wide doors of the internet opened up, that meant a lot more places we could follow them.
Hopefully the Rube Goldberg machine will at least get us into the Simpsons again.
We get asked all the time, like, let's see how to say this, that usually it is thought about in our presence that these things we are doing are all really Machiavellian clever marketing schemes, and it's just they're we're making the things we want to make, and it's we're lucky to live in an era when the definitions are so unclear, and the sort of categories for creativity are blending so rapidly that you can't really tell the difference between what is the end product and what is referring to the end product, and it doesn't really even matter. We don't make these videos so that we will become a huge band. You know, we make these videos because they're fun to make. We make these videos because they're for the same reason you might make a song. I mean, every time you hear someone who tries to write a hit, it's awful. And then when you hear somebody who tries to write a great song, it, you know, sometimes they fail and sometimes they succeed. But we make these things because we like making them. It's not like
that's our perspective on it.
Yeah.
You know, on that first day of MTV, I haven't seen the stats, but they were probably, MTV was picked up by maybe 10% of cable television in the United States. The world didn't watch it. Way before that, as we all know, all you have to do now, go on YouTube and you can see music videos, you know, from 1956, when you come right down to it, except we didn't call them that back then.
Sure.
It was just somebody trying to portray their music, you know, in a visual medium versus an audio medium. So it's been 12 years to this point, and I just want to get to the dark side really fast and get out of it. You've created something new, and the reason you've created something new was a reaction to all of this technological stuff that's going on, and it involves goofy stuff like money and rights and big record companies. And it's not that the big record companies are evil per se, it's that the industry really has changed and they're just trying to figure out how they're going to live. Your story in some ways has been overshadowed by all the things that have transpired the next few months, you know, past months. Of going out there and doing your own thing.
We're on EMI, we're on Capitol Records, which is a subsidiary of EMI. from 2001 till just this year. I think we left it technically in early March. We've had a lot of good, you know, we've had a lot of success with our label over the years, and a lot of things that we disagree with them about. But like you said, we generally don't see the labels themselves as evil. In truth, they often are, but ours was no more or less evil than any other major label. The fact is, there's a distribution system that was set up to connect the endpoints between musicians and listeners. And over the course of 80 years or so, the feedback loop through that system, you know, things becoming successful in that system, built the system up itself, and the system then started, you know, more or less defining what could be made and what success looked like and all those sorts of things. And by the time we were born in the 70s, and certainly by the time we were listening to music in the 80s and 90s, the industry had worked out a pretty good way of you know, really making hits and making a lot of money. And it did not always crush artists or crush creativity or artful music or anything.
Typical success was like video on MTV, song on radio.
Yeah, and you know for something to be a financially viable creative musical project, it certainly had to have those elements. And that is, you know, that doesn't, there's nothing wrong with making a great video in the MTV era or the MTV style. And there's nothing wrong with the hits that were on radio in the 90s or early aughts or any of those things. It's just that they're preclusive of a lot of other great stuff. And from an artist perspective, what we want to do is be making the things that excite us the most and not necessarily trying to rehabilitate a system that has lost its main building block, which is record sales. What we want to do is chase down the ideas that excite us the most. And so that just doesn't align very well with the aims of the industry anymore. They have built their entire model on selling master recordings, you know, whether that's digitally or on CDs or, you know, I'm sorry, digitally transferred or on digital CDs or, you know, on records or tapes or 8-tracks or anything. And that is the one part of the industry that has basically folded in on itself, which doesn't hurt creativity at all. It just means we need a new model for how we pay for it. And from a band's perspective, it doesn't matter whether our money comes from selling the costumes in our videos or, you know, I mean, straight up begging from our fans or from, you know, like from various underwriters, as long, you know, we're careful about who we work with, or we try to be careful about who we work with. But there's nothing inherently more onerous about the corporations who sell clothing than there are about the corporations who sell compact discs, you know, unless I guess you talk about sweatshops, maybe there's something more onerous. But basically, you know, there's a lot of corporate money out there in the world. It's always a little nerve-wracking to get involved with it, but no more so than it was with a major label. So we have gone out into the world seeking new paths. And so we now run our own distribution and our own, you know, everything that a record label would have done for us, we now do for ourselves. Plus, we do it a lot differently than they did.
And by the way, I have that insurance company, so I'm actually okay with that. Our last video was underwritten by State Farm Insurance. They're actually my insurance company, so I'm okay with that. Can you blame the art teacher in art camp for all of this? Can we like someday call her up and say, listen, their big damnation and their quest for freedom, you're responsible for it. Can we get back to that?
If you'd like to, I think that's your prerogative. Yeah, Tim and I have been making stuff together since we were 12. And we both wound up. We wound up at a summer camp for young, arty, nerdy kids, because we were people who wanted to chase our creative ideas, and we've been, I mean, amazingly lucky to be able to continue the project. You know, we were at Google yesterday, and I tell you, Google is a fantastic and really inspiring place. But I was surprised that, you know, how nostalgic I was actually being in the halls there for a 9-to-5 job. I mean, I sort of was like, you know, these people are all working on interesting things, but they also leave it at work eventually. I mean, you know, a lot of Googlers work very late, I'm sure, but yeah. But I remember the days when I used to work in offices doing stuff that I liked. I mean, it wasn't stuff, it weren't the passions of my life, but I worked as a radio engineer at NPR, and I worked as a graphic designer for a while, and doing things where you were like, you worked with intelligent people throughout the day, and you had problems you needed to solve, and then at night you actually went home and played music or did whatever you wanted to instead of you know, like the living that we have now, which is sort of, you know, 26 hours a day chasing muse, which, man, I'm making the reverse point of the one I mean to be making, which is that we really, really feel truly blessed doing what we're doing. I just mean that our visit there yesterday highlighted to me, like, wow, we really live a different life than even the most creative sort of like corporate environments. We are, it's very different living in a bus.
This is so basic, and yet it's so Museum of Modern Art at exactly.
You're talking about the cover art.
Yeah, I'm talking about the cover art and the inside art and the way that you think about how you do all of this.
Yeah, the cover art for our CD is the record is named after an 1876 book on the healing powers of blue light, of which there are apparently none. But in 1876, this one retired Army general believed he had found that blue light was the cure to basically all human ills.
He had done a good job of convincing other people of the same thing.
Yeah, he actually managed to get a patent on the color blue from the U.S. Patent Office, which was the sort of the factoid that led us to this whole thing. Just the ridiculous beauty of the sort of poetry of absurdity of getting a patent on a color. Anyways, we compared the text of our record, the actual lyrics of our record, with the text of the sort of thesis statement segment of the book. Both of them wound up being about 500 sentences. So we compared them in grammatically, thematically, structurally, rhythmically, and a few other different ways. And all of the graphics in the record cover are actually they're visual representations of that data. It's astonishingly beautiful. If I do say so myself, it was done by two British designers that we worked very closely with, and we're very proud of it.
Now, but then the narrative that I'm finding in the songs are they supposed to be blue songs, as in I'm blue and as an unrequited love, and you know the last autumn leaf hanging from the tree and the hen house and all of these other things? Because if you're geeky like me and you actually sit there and read the lyrics and then play the songs and repeat some of the lyrics to your listeners, you know, there's something deep going on here, or maybe not.
Well, it's a very it's definitely a heart on the sleeve kind of record. We toured on our last album for 31 months, which is just, you know, that's longer than one should tour and still try to stay sane. I think we were, you know, when we got back, we had a lot of internal crises about our own lives, our own relationships, and certainly our sort of relationship to our creative work. It was very hard to get writing again in a way that made us feel like we were doing something other than just kind of following our own patterns. You know, it didn't feel very honest or exciting for several months. And so I think we kind of had to hit these crises and figure, you know, face the problem face to face and kind of come up with a new way of writing music and a new way of thinking about our lives at large. You know, it sounds really overwrought and pretentious, but it was a very emotional time, and you can definitely hear it in the record, you know?
I had my little computer here, and I heard the sound, and again, the last band that I heard a similar sound from was Mercury Rev. So was part of hiring Mr. Dave, when you sign up with him, your output, no matter who you are, you know, there's going to be a certain crunch to the highs, and there's going to be certain things that happen that ears can hear it. Now, I think that's fantastic, but was your choice because you wanted to push a certain way, because you wanted someone to take you different places?
Dave, we have worked hard in the past to find people who did not have sonic signatures, and Dave clearly does. The thing is, we do really like his sound, and I think this was the first record on which we felt confident enough in the writing going into it that writing had a very specific goal, like that you could hear in the demos where these songs were supposed to wind up, that there was no way Dave's the sort of influence of Dave's sound would derail what they were supposed to be doing. On top of which, the demos sort of already sounded like the poor man's Dave Fridman. I mean, we're very influenced by his sound. I think he's one of the most really artful engineers of our era. Because there's recording and producing music has gotten to be something that so many people can do, and the tools of doing it are so easily accessible that it's really spread wide, and there are very few people who've made an incredible art out of it. And those who have tend to be students of the the very persnickety rules of the 70s and 80s. Kind of you got a lot of SSL drum sounds and stuff, and we wanted we really like working with somebody who will try to push the barriers with us. And Dave really does not care about trying to make massive success in the footsteps of people who've come before him.
Makes that pretty clear too.
Yeah. He really, what he idolizes are the turning points in music. And if he doesn't ever get what he believes is one of them, he'll go to his grave happy trying. I mean, I think he's actually hit many of them. I think the Soft Bulletin is one of those things that just changed the way music was made forever after it. But he looks at things that you and I don't see as big moments, a particular pop song from some total throwaway artist from 1982 or something that he sees as the moment.
Everybody would assume that this is quadruple platinum, right? It's, that it's been in heavy rotation on every top 40 radio station in the United States.
Yeah.
And that you came to San Francisco and you played the Boston Garden, which would be physically impossible. But there are bands that are capable of moving the Boston Garden to wherever they want to, because it just follows them around.
Yeah, exactly. U2 actually takes it with them on a bus.
Yeah, they do. Well, it's amazing, you know how they do it. They just take the little air thing and they shrink it, and it goes, it disappears, which I think is spectacular.
Well, we're sold out the Fillmore for tonight. It's not exactly the Boston Garden, but we do fine. We're not. You're right. We are not massive, but it.
And that wasn't an insult.
Oh no, no, I'm not,
yeah,
we don't take it as one.
As one.
We're there's so many places this conversation could go. If nobody would turn down the bank accounts of U2 or Green Day, but I'm not sure that I would actually want to do what they're doing day in and day out. Which is, and that sounds very sour grapes, but it's. We could not be more excited about the things we get to do, honestly. And there are, at moments when it's unclear if we'll be able to pay our mortgage next year, then it can be, anxiety inducing. But for the most part, over the last 12 years of being in a rock band, every year has been better than the one before it. And so if we could make that last for another 20, 30 years, or even 5, 10 years. I mean, I remember when we first started, we were a little older than most rock bands. I mean, we're not ancient, but, we all got through college and then started a rock band. So we're, in our early 20s and realizing that the life expectancy of most rock bands is 10, 15 years. So that puts us squarely in our 30s with no job, no anything, no whatever. And it seemed kind of dumb, right? But this is what we wanted to do with our lives. And big radio bands and that kind of stuff, you have one big hit and you basically have to play not just that individual song, but all the facsimiles of that song that you then have to write for the next 10-15 years so that you can keep your records on the shelves of Walmart
and hope that the world still likes that song 10 years later,
right? And then and then suffer through the 10-year period during which they hate you so that you can do a comeback and hopefully they like, hopefully you're, at that point you are the Pixies, not REM. Pixies, not OMD. You know what I mean? Like, we've been to both reunion tours recently, and one was significantly more wonderful than the other. If you know what I'm talking about.
Obviously, the OMD was just through the roof.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I love myself at the OMD.
No,
concert.
I love OMD too. There are just several bands that the need for a reunion tour. Now, Oasis.
You can judge
is still,
it by how many times they play their single in a given night. They played.
Right.
They played If You Leave 3 times that night.
Seriously.
Actually, yes.
Cool.
But, the thing is, we don't. At the end of the day, if we can keep on chasing I sound like a broken record here, but if we can keep chasing our creative ideas, that's enough. That's it. And in fact, I think embedded in the question, like you're getting bajillions of views, but where are the record sales? It's sort of like being like, man, the internet is just like, if there's so much communication happening, but where are the telegraph sales? Well, you don't need telegraph sales to make the internet happen. You know what I mean? Our fan base is getting bigger and bigger every day, and we have more and more creative opportunities every day, which is what's really most exciting. I mean, after the treadmills, yes, a lot more people knew who we were, but the single part of that really meant a difference to us was that we could walk into a meeting of engineers and say, you guys want to make a giant Rube Goldberg machine? I mean, we never could have pulled off the Rube Goldberg machine. Nobody would have trusted that we could do such a thing, you know? And with every success, new creative pathways open up, and that's what keeps life exciting, you know?
Last weekend, you played underwater.
Yes.
Tell me about that. What's it like playing underwater? Yeah, could you sing one of the songs underwater for me? That's
Well, we need a lot of water. But we did, we went to the Maker Faire just outside of San Francisco, and I was submerged in a big bag, a big man-shaped bag of water. The contraption is called Water Boy and was built by a genius named Mark Kornblatt, who is from San Francisco.
Yeah.
And I'm not even sure if he wants his real name revealed, because I believe he now goes by Water Boy, but I just revealed his real name. So I basically get in this big clear plastic man-shaped encasement where I am entirely underwater but standing upright with a breathing apparatus over my head, and Tim and the rest of the band had sort of the equivalent of an old diving suit, you know, like the air bubble over your head, except it was inverted, so that it was a water bubble over their head, and with a snorkel coming out of it. So they looked, you know, they essentially looked like they were wearing a big space suit filled with water. And they played their guitars while I sang through my breathing apparatus, and the people of Maker Faire were treated to what we believe is the first underwater acoustic performance.
So what are you going to do now to top that in the live show? What can people expect? What are some of the... Because the other thing about being artistic, about being creative, right, is that if you walked out there and you just played guitars and drums and you wore all white, right, what would happen then?
The thing is, I think what if you do... Our single guiding principle, I mean, people probably don't believe this coming from us, because there's always something crazy going on stage, but really the single guiding principle is doing things that we have emotional resonance to us and make us really excited. And I've seen plenty of performances where it's one dude and acoustic guitar that bring me to tears, you know. We could put a show on like that that would work. We probably one day will, because you sort of all, you know, there will be, at some point, there will be nothing more surprising to our fan base than not having 1,000 confetti cannons and and an underwater performance. So one day we'll probably do a full acoustic tour. Who knows? And we've been doing a lot of acoustic shows on this tour, actually, but topping oneself is never really the goal. I mean, that leads you back into that sort of the Walmart mode. Like, how do you keep all the people engaged all the time?
Seems,
you know,
anti-productive.
Yeah, I mean, the only people we have to impress all the time are ourselves, and we are our own worst critics, and we do not particularly like most of the things we make. So there's a lot of the ones you see we mostly like, but we make a lot of crap we hate.
So the last thing, we did this 4 years ago, but I want to do an updated version because I now have this.
Nice.
We did a thing called a musical sandwich, and you might not remember what this was.
No, I do remember. This was when we had to trade off words in a liner.
Well, no. It was where we took two of your songs as the bread and we put other music in between.
Oh, right.